and have a good day.
And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Thursday edition now of It's Your Turn. We start with Open Talk today. Our phone number is 283-2525 if you'd like to join our conversation at any time. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about the great artist, the great inventor, the great thinker, Leonardo da Vinci. This year marks the 500th anniversary of the death of Leonardo da Vinci. And we're going to be talking with a couple of gentlemen who have written a book about Leonardo and his career. And it's a beautiful book, has a lot of color reproductions of some of his many paintings and works and so on. A fascinating man, truly a Renaissance man, literally and figuratively. So if you want to learn a little bit more about Leonardo da Vinci, as I do, you'll be interested, I think, in our talk a little bit later on the program today. And also today we're going to be talking about what one woman says is a bottle of lies. And she's talking about the boom in generic drugs. Well, that's kind of eye-raising. Huh? Catherine Eban is her name. We'll talk to her a little bit later on the program as well. But first, it's Open Talk, 283-2525. 283-2525 is the number. When should kids get a cell phone? Interesting question. I saw a story on the wire just a couple of days ago. And it was a study that had been done, and the study purportedly found that the best age for a child's first cell phone is 12. And my first thought was, a little early? I don't know. Maybe. I mean, it's hard to keep up with the changing times today. I would think maybe a little bit later, 12. I mean, when I was 12, I was in sixth grade. I didn't know up from down, sideways, from whatever. I mean, you're still a kid, aren't you? Age 12, I think so. I certainly was. You get a little bit older, you get into junior high school. Certainly high school, okay. I don't know. Maybe some of you folks with kids or grandkids know, is 12 the right age for kids to get their first cell phone? I certainly wouldn't do it any earlier than that, although I know of families where there are kids who are a lot younger than that who have phones. I've seen them, you know, in stores and so on. Restaurants, everywhere. What do you think? I don't know. Not a question I have to deal with, but just interesting. O.J. Simpson, in his first tweet, yes, he's got a Twitter feed now. I do not follow Twitter. I don't care to, and I don't think I ever will, quite frankly. I got enough to do in my life without following hundreds of people's Twitter feeds. But I didn't even realize O.J. Simpson was out of jail. He was granted parole 2 years ago after serving 9 years in prison in connection with a robbery in Las Vegas in which he tried to retrieve memorabilia that he claimed belonged to him. Now, you know, he did not go to prison for the murders of his wife, his former wife, Nicole Brown, and the other gentlemen who were found brutally murdered. O.J. Simpson was acquitted in that trial. He was in the news again within the past week because it was the anniversary, it was a couple of days ago, the anniversary of the Slow Pursuit. Those of you who are old enough to remember that on TV, it was a slow speed police chase that was followed with helicopter cameras on all the major networks. O.J. wouldn't stop. He was in a white pickup truck. I can remember watching that on TV that afternoon. And he finally went back to his home and then surrendered to police. But when his trial, which was what a lot of people called the trial of the century, was televised. I can remember. It was on every day. It was unbelievable. Every day. And you'd watch that judge and those prosecutors, and they'd go at it. And he was acquitted. He was acquitted. Now, there was a civil case later where, as I recall, he was ordered to pay some money. But he finally went to jail on this robbery conviction in Las Vegas. And he was in jail for 9 years, but he was granted parole 2 years ago. I didn't know that. O.J. Simpson. There are some people who think that he got away with murder. I mean, you know, that's a figure of speech, but in his case, literally, there are some people that think he got away with murder. I don't know. The years have gone by. I know that I watched some of the trial. It was riveting. You couldn't help but watch it. It was on TV every day. In California, they allow their trials to be televised. We do not here in Pennsylvania, by the way. Some states do, some states don't. But the details get a little bit foggy after, you know, a few decades. What was it? 20 years ago? 25 years ago? 30 years ago? Really? Wow. But there are some people that think that, you know, he should have been convicted. That it was a crazy time, crazy trial. Prosecutors didn't do a good job. His defense team, he had a whole flock of big-name, expensive lawyers on his defense team. I don't know. It's funny, when I saw the news story, I didn't even realize that he was out of jail. Open talk at 283-2525, our number 283-2525. Has anybody been to Disney World down in Florida? Pat Parker, have you been there? I saw a story, it was today as a matter of fact, I was on CBS Radio News here on WISR, I'll read you this. The happiest place on earth just got more expensive. Walt Disney World's annual pass holders are about to feel the pinch of a price increase. Pass holders can expect to pay anywhere from $150 to $255 more dollars. Now, I've never been to Disney World. That's how much it costs? I didn't realize. I don't know. Is it that much a day? Can't be, can it? I don't know. When you go there, do you buy a pass for, you know, like a 3-day pass or a week-long pass or something? I don't know. I've never been there and really have no burning desire to, but I guess it's really, really expensive. You know, if you went down there with your family, a couple of kids, that would be a lot of money. But it says here, pass holders can expect to pay anywhere from $150 to $255 more dollars, depending on which pass they have. All of this because of the elaborate Star Wars land. I guess that's a new, whatever they call it down there, a new neighborhood, new attraction. That's going to be opening in a couple of months in August. Whew, wow. Expensive to go down there. And then they want you to, I see the ads on TV. They want you to stay in the Disneyland Hotel and ride the Disneyland monorail and all that stuff. I didn't realize it cost that much. 283-2525 is our number. It's open talk. Let's get to the people and see what they have to say here today. Hi there. This is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Okay. As far as computers, I think they should learn everything else first and then get on the computers.
You're talking about kids in school, you mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That way it gives them, you know, to learn something else instead of staying on a computer, you know.
Well, I might disagree with you a little bit on that. I don't see any problem with young kids, very young kids, as a matter of fact, learning to use a computer. I mean, that's obviously that's the way we're going to learn things,
yeah.
You know, from now on, and they might as well start doing it. Well, but I was talking about a cell phone,
okay.
Which is in effect it's a mini computer, but. If you're just using, a computer in school, you can't make calls with it. Cell phone, that's a different story, and kids can use that, you know, when they're off on their own. And I don't know. When do you think it's time for a kid to get his first cell phone?
Maybe driver's license.
16. Well, might be a little earlier than that, I think.
Yeah, 14 maybe, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard for us because we didn't have these things when we were that age, you know.
Yeah, that's for sure, huh?
We
want the book in hand, or
I wish I would have had computers, quite frankly. I was looking up something yesterday. A question came up in my mind, and I literally had the answer within about 15 seconds. Because I was sitting at my desk and my computer terminal was open and I Googled it and there was the answer. And I thought to myself, my goodness, in the olden days, it would have taken me a couple of days to have to go to the library to look that up, you know?
Well, I remember when they were teaching at Butler Community College back in the 70s, Blair.
Yeah.
That was way over my head, but...
Well, they've come a long way since then, obviously. And I'm not a believer in scrapping multiplication tables and that sort of thing. I still think kids could learn to do that. But I don't have any problem with starting on computers. You know, in the elementary grades, first, second grade, that's fine with me.
I forget his name. He was a pretty smart professor, but that's too much for me to learn.
Mm-hmm. All right, my friend. Hey.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure, good to talk with you.
Have a nice day.
And you. 283-2525 is the number. One thing that I was reading about a couple of months ago is the fact that in many schools they don't teach writing anymore. I'm not talking about, literature writing. I'm talking about cursive writing. You know, the ovals and the... things we used to do when we were learning how to write. Apparently, they don't teach that in many, many schools these days because kids use a keyboard for everything. Whether they're using a computer or, if it's an iPad or a tablet or if it's a phone, they're typing everything. They don't write. Or if they do use a pencil or a pen, they're printing. You know? Now, most people that I know, their writing has changed over the years. Mine has changed a great deal. You know, if I ever had a specimen of my writing in sixth or seventh grade, it would probably be unrecognizable today because you change when you. Get older, you're writing faster, you're scribbling sometimes. I actually use kind of a combination of printing and writing. There are some letters that just over the years I tend to print. It's kind of a hybrid for me, but it's fast and I can do it. And I suppose if I sat down and took my time, I could still have passable, maybe not beautiful, but passable cursive writing. But I guess there's a lot of kids these days that have no idea how to do it. No. And a lot of school districts are saying, we don't need it. Why bother? Other things to learn. 283-2525 is our number. 283-2525. Open talk on the program today. Are you worried at all about more war in the Middle East, specifically with Iran? You know, tensions have been building for a couple of weeks now. We've sent an aircraft carrier over there, and President Trump talking about 1,000 troops and so on. And we had the attacks on a couple of international tankers, not American ships, by the way. One was Japanese last week, and I forget what the other one was. But the latest story, and that's just in the news today, about Iran shooting down a U.S. drone. And where was it? Well, that's in dispute. It's just, it's kind of scary. But I can't imagine that the American people, you know, unless there's something really drastic that happens, would support another war in the Middle East. I mean, most folks are, you know, just tired of it. People that I talk to anyway say, let's get out of there. We're still in Afghanistan. My goodness, it's 15, 16 years since we invaded Afghanistan. 15 plus years. World War II, for all of its horrors, lasted 4 years. 1941, late 1941, December, to 1945. And that was it. And look how long we've been in Afghanistan. And, of course, before that, there was the Persian Gulf War, and then the invasion of Iraq, and then Afghanistan. And I don't know whether the American people would get behind another war. And, you know, with Iran, that's a whole lot different than going after Saddam Hussein in Baghdad, which, you know, that was nothing. We did that in nothing flat. Iran, that's a, first of all, it's a bigger country, more people, more advanced. I don't know. And, you know, you would hope that they could dampen down these tensions that seem to be building. Is it just saber rattling and nothing more? Boy, I would hope so. I would hope so. 283-2525 is our number. 283-2525. Open talk here on the program today. 283-2525. President Trump, and I had to chuckle at this, because he officially announced his campaign for re-election a couple of nights ago, held a big rally down in Orlando, Florida. All the candidates seem to do this now. They come out and they say, well, we're going to officially announce, but they're already running. And Trump has been running, really, since he was first elected. And most candidates are. But he has held, I believe I heard on the news that this was his 60th campaign rally since he was elected. I mean, he does these every couple of weeks somewhere. And well, he was at full speed in Orlando a couple of nights ago. I saw some of the sound bites of it, you know. Do we need these? This is the official. Forget whatever you've heard before. Officially now, I'm running for re-election. I have to laugh. And that, by the way, that it's not just for Trump. It's for other people that do that, too. Okay, you're officially running now. Let's get back to the people and see what they have to say today. Our phone number is 283-2525. Hi there, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Dave, you was talking about Disney World.
Yes, yes. Have you been there?
Yeah, I was there. Oh, it was a while back when they first opened, and then about 10 years later, I think on radio the other day, they have a ride down there now. And the waiting line is 5 hours.
5 hours?
5 hours to get on this ride.
My goodness. Not for me, I'm sorry to say. Not for me.
No. Well, I think them too. There's actually a city underneath Disney World.
I didn't know. I've never been there, so I don't know. You're talking about the one in Florida now, right? Disney World.
Yeah. The one in Florida, they have a four-lane highway underneath.
Oh, my.
They have a hospital down there. They have a water plant, electric plant. They make the stuff for upstairs. Everything goes up by elevator.
I didn't realize, I've never been there, so I didn't realize how expensive it was. I guess you have to buy a pass to get in there. Is that the deal?
That I couldn't tell you. Back when I was here, it was only like $40. I couldn't tell you. Somebody will probably call it, you know.
I'm just thinking to myself when I saw this latest story that, you go down there, you know, the family, a couple of kids or whatever, it's going to be a small fortune down there.
I had a Pittsburgh station on. This guy came out with a book, and they're going to make a movie out of it. It's called A Chicken Ran at Midnight. It's a true story.
I haven't heard about it. What's it about?
This one young girl, she had a brain tumor behind her eye. Okay, it was like inoperable. And like she told her dad, she kept on saying, "Daddy, it's not your fault." Because some kids blame their parents, you know what I mean, for having a defect.
Yeah. Was this a true story, or is it a...
No, it's a true story.
Oh, wow.
But she was sitting in the back seat of the car, and she just blurted out, "The chicken ran at midnight for no reason at all," okay?
Mm-hmm.
And,
it was because of this tumor that was affecting her?
I don't know what they're going to say. But like, had a baseball game. This is on the West Coast. And like, there was this one guy, the bat, he put his arms up and down like a chicken.
Yeah. Got me on that. I'll have to check into that, my friend.
But, yeah.
You say it's a new book, it's just being published?
I heard this about 2 months ago, The Chicken Ran at Midnight. And then after that, the guy's brother, not brother, son, put this lady off the road. She was pregnant. And, like, he sacrificed his life. He got killed doing this. And I don't think it's going to be a tearjerker.
I'll check it out, my friend. Thanks for bringing it. Thanks for bringing it to my attention. Yeah, thank you. We have to get ready to welcome our initial guests here today. So let's take a quick break, and then we'll do that. We're going to be talking about Leonardo da Vinci, his life, his incredible body of work, and his death, because this year marks the 500th year since the death of Leonardo da Vinci. So stick around. That'll be coming up here in just a moment. One of our sponsors on the program today is the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler, reminding you that once again this year they're going to be collecting any excess produce from backyard gardeners for the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank. Now, most folks already have their gardens in. Maybe you're going to be planting some late lettuce or something like that. But a lot of folks say, well, you know, the last couple of tomato plants in this row, anything I get off of those tomato plants going to St. Vincent de Paul, or peppers or beans or whatever. It's a wonderful thing for the families who rely on the food bank, fresh, nutritious produce. We'll be telling you the details about their pickup program in another couple of weeks, but just keep it in mind. It's a good idea. This has been a very successful program for the past few summers now. Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank, located on Elm Street here in the city of Butler, and they serve a lot of families. At St. Vincent de Paul, they like to say we stand tallest when we stoop to help others. It's a wonderful thought. We'll be back to talk about Leonardo da Vinci.
Michael's Restaurant is now open for breakfast at 7 a.m. Join us for breakfast any day of the week, including after church on Sundays. Have you made plans for dinner yet? Bring the family for a great home-cooked meal. Michael's Restaurant also offers great Sunday dinner specials, stuffed chicken breasts, stuffed pork chops, lasagna, and more.
How would you describe driving and parking in Pittsburgh? Long, stressful? How about expensive? If you are answered yes to any of these, then the Butler Transit Authority is here to help. With comfy coach buses equipped with free Wi-Fi and USB ports, commute to Pittsburgh stress-free and economically. With fares starting at just $3.87, not sure if it's for you? Try it out for free. BTA is offering 4 full weeks of transportation completely free the third week of May, June, July, and August. For more information, schedules, and park and ride locations, visit butlertransit.com.
Listeners, I think you're going to be intrigued on our next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. I'm certainly looking forward to talking to our two guests. They both join us by telephone here today, Jean-Pierre Ispoutz and Dr. Christopher Brown. We're going to be talking about Leonardo da Vinci. First of all, gentlemen, thanks for being with us here today. I'm anxious to talk to you.
Thanks for having us.
This is a significant year when we're talking about Leonardo da Vinci. It's the 500th anniversary of his death. And you've written an illustrated book that is available. Can you tell us a little bit, Jean-Pierre, about the book?
Sure. It's what struck us as we thought about writing this book, the Da Vinci Legacy, is that when Leonardo died, he was really a forgotten artist. He went to exile in France. He died as a recluse in Italy. His fame was long overshadowed by Raphael and Michelangelo. And yet today, he's the most famous artist. His work, the Salvator Mundi, just sold for $500 million. So we were asking ourselves, what the heck happened? How could someone who was all but forgotten 500 years ago become so famous? And that's the arc that we're trying to trace in this book.
Dr. Brown, I knew, you know, a little bit about Leonardo da Vinci. I had no idea that he died as almost a recluse, right?
Well, that's correct. For the last 3 years of his life, Leonardo lived with the French king, and records have it that they would meet every day, and they would talk, and they would chat, and the very last three paintings that Leonardo had with him at that period of time were then accepted by the French king, or perhaps the French king paid for them, although we can't find a receipt for the payment, per se. Those three paintings were the Mona Lisa, and Saint Anne, the Virgin and Child, and John the Baptist. And the French king was really trying to bring a cultural change with art into France at that period of time, and was just fascinated by not only Leonardo's art, but all his writings and his notebooks about science and nature and his observation and engineering and war machines. So even though Leonardo was probably one of the most brilliant human beings in the world, I think the French king realized that. But at the same point, nobody else really knew, just the French king and Leonardo at the end.
By the way, Dr. Brown, is that how the Mona Lisa ended up at the Louvre in Paris, or no?
Yeah, correct. That's exactly how it ended up there. There are some records and some misunderstandings about potentially another Mona Lisa painting in the possession of Sally, but we believe that to be a copy and not this painting. And more likely than not, the Louvre Mona Lisa has never left Paris since it was taken there.
Probably the most famous painting in the world. Just about everybody has heard of it. I was somewhat surprised when I saw it in person about the size of it. I thought it would be much bigger. It's actually a rather small painting, is it not?
It's a very small painting, and what our book shows is that there are actually two Mona Lisas that Leonardo painted. This may come as a shock to your listeners, but we found that there was a earlier Mona Lisa, a first version of the Mona Lisa, which is actually a portrait, a likeness of this beautiful young woman. She was 23 years at the time, Lisa del Giocondo, wife of a Florentine silk merchant. And then 10 years later, Leonardo decided to return to the theme, using his drawings and sketches of Lisa, but to create something very, very different. And that is the second portrait, which now hangs in the Louvre.
Wow. Wow. Dr. Brown, tell us a little bit about these multispectral scans that you were doing of a copy of The Last Supper. What was that all about?
Actually, I'm going to let Jean-Pierre answer this one because he's been recently working with some pretty amazing technology. And Jean-Pierre, why don't you answer this one?
Sure. Chris Brown and I found out that there, just like Leonardo painted a second version of the Mona Lisa, he also painted a second version of The Last Supper. And that's great because if your listeners have been to Milan and seen the original fresco of The Last Supper, they will have seen that the fresco is terribly decayed. Only some 20% is still visible of that original painting because Leonardo experimented with his pigments and it didn't stick to the wall. So the second version, which we found in a monastery in Belgium, is in fact the second version of The Last Supper, painted by Leonardo's workshop under his direction. And Chris and I sort of felt that the two figures in this painting, Christ as well as John the Apostle, really felt like this was painted by Leonardo himself, not by his pupils. And so we conducted a multispectral study, and we found, without a doubt, that certainly the figure of John was painted by Leonardo himself. Multispectral technology allows you to see things that the human eye does not see. You really look underneath the paint layer, and you can see fascinating things.
Hmm. I was not aware that there was a copy of The Last Supper. Is it pretty much the same as the original fresco?
Yeah, it's almost to scale. It's huge, and it's been in this monastery, which is why not many people know about it. But when we announced the results of the study just a month ago, we had lots of TV networks and national papers throughout Europe attending it. But now we're bringing this news for the first time to an American audience.
And I'd like to add that, you know, part of the reason that this is such a significant finding is, again, in Milan, The Last Supper is only 20% of what Leonardo painted is there. This canvas, although it has a little damage, is almost like it was painted yesterday. And it's in the same scale. The same cartoons were used to paint all the other apostles, with the exception of the Christ and John position. So we were able to take this canvas and in a 3D manner place it back into Milan with the windows and the interplay of light and of the light and the sun coming through the windows. And you get a beautiful three-dimensional feel of what The Last Supper would have looked like in the 1500s.
And the original was a fresco. Some of our listeners may not be familiar with that term and how it differs from a painting. Can either one of you address that?
Sure. A fresco is painted on a wet plaster wall. So what you do is you cover the wall with wet plaster to make it very smooth, and then you use tempera paint, which is paint based on egg yolk, which dries very, very quickly and then bonds with the wall, so it stays there for many centuries. But Leonardo didn't like tempera paint. He wanted to use oils because it was with oils that he created these beautiful three-dimensional effects of light and tone and shade of his beautiful portraits in the Milan period. So he wanted to do the same thing. He could not bring himself to use tempera paint, and as a result, well, he used oils, and oils on a wet wall doesn't work. What's more, the wall was adjoining the kitchen because it was painted in the refectory where the monks come together and have meals. So obviously there was a lot of moisture seeping through the wall from the adjoining kitchen, and that also added to the destruction of the fresco.
We're talking, listeners, here on the It's Your Turn program today with Jean-Pierre Ispoutz and Dr. Christopher Brown. They are the co-authors of a new illustrated book, The Da Vinci Legacy. And I understand, Dr. Brown, that there's also a PBS TV special based on your book. Has that aired already, or is that still to come?
Yes, it has aired, but over the next 3 months, I think it'll be on all the viewing areas. Morgan Freeman actually did the narration or the voiceover for the movie, which is called Search for the Mona Lisa. And this is actually our second broadcast on PBS. The first one was called Search for the Last Supper, which is what we were just speaking about, the Last Supper painting that's in the Belgian monastery. We really enjoyed working with Morgan Freeman on this, and we basically, this is tied into our new book, The Da Vinci Legacy, of course, and really, you know, discusses a lot of the relationship between the earlier Mona Lisa and the Louvre Mona Lisa, and again, then into, you know, why Leonardo da Vinci, even today, is still a pop icon, or why he's so famous even 500 years later.
Jean-Pierre, are we pretty sure of the portrait of the Mona Lisa in terms of who it is a portrait of in real life?
Well, as it happened, this earlier Mona Lisa that Chris is referring to, the first version of the Mona Lisa, has been in vaults for the last century or so, and it just went on public exhibit for the first time in Florence, Italy, the city of her birth, of course. That's where the Mona Lisa came from. And I was there. There was a press conference, unfortunately only for Italian media, but we trust that the news of this great exhibit will travel and that people will go and see it, because, you know, Chris and I were just blown away when we saw this earlier version of the Mona Lisa for the first time. Here's a really beautiful young woman, whereas in the Louvre, you're looking at a much older, matronly figure, and it's covered with this dark hue that makes it very difficult to see what's going on. The early Mona Lisa is radically different, and it's just a gorgeous piece.
We've been concentrating on Leonardo da Vinci as a painter and his fresco, of course. But Dr. Brown, my goodness, he was so many other things, including a tremendous inventor, and even though some of his inventions didn't come to fruition, the drawings of them came later. I'm thinking, for example, of a helicopter. Didn't he have early drawings of what we now know as helicopters?
Yes, a helicopter and parachutes. And, you know, Leonardo da Vinci is probably one of the most brilliant human beings that's ever lived. And part of this reason that he's such the Renaissance man is he was one of the first people to observe nature and then apply nature into scientific type of research. And again, he studied the birds, and the birds then related to flying machines and parachutes and other type of contraptions. It's not well known, but Leonardo da Vinci basically in the 1500s and also invented steam or steam locomotion. And that was the beginning of the industrial age. That would happen, some 300 years later. So this you know, man is absolutely brilliant. He also built a tank, for example, and he was so smart that he was worried that if somebody was to find his plans of his tank, that they might use it against the people that he was selling the drawings to. So he put errors in there so that if they built the tank, it wouldn't work. And in fact, when people first built his tank, they couldn't get it to work until they fixed several of the errors that he had purposely put into his drawings.
Amazing. Are his drawings and notebooks and sketchbooks well preserved, Doctor?
Actually, they are pretty well preserved. Bill Gates, several years ago, bought 8 pages of a codex, and I think he paid $35 million, so that's basically $4 to $5 million per page. I believe we only think that there's about 30% of his notebooks that are available in the world. 70% are probably in Swiss bank vaults or lost or have been broken up and sold as separate pages throughout the years. There's probably a lot more information out there that we would love to see, because, again, this man was ingenious.
A couple of more questions for our guests, co-authors of the illustrated book, The Da Vinci Legacy. Jean-Pierre, were you able to talk a little bit about his life? For example, as a child, when did he learn to paint? Did he go to school somewhere?
Well, that's actually a beautiful story, or also a bit of a tragic story, because Leonardo was a natural child, which means that he was the outcome of a fling, of a late summer night fling, between a very promising young notary, Ser Piero, and a very beautiful farm maid. And, of course, there was no question that the two could marry. I mean, in those days, the social gulf was too large. So Ser Piero went off and married somebody else. And Catarina, his mother, also married someone, a bricklayer. And after 5 years, the bricklayer decided that young Leonardo would have to leave because he had just too many mouths to feed. And so Leonardo was taken away from his mother when he was 5 years old, which is a very traumatic experience for a young child. And I think that haunted him throughout his life. And And that's one of the reasons why he always was had a very ambivalent attitude towards women. He saw them as mothers, as the mothers he never knew, and that's what's reflected in his beautiful Madonna paintings that he painted in the workshop of Andrea del Verrocchio, a very successful painter, where he did receive an education, not as much of an education he would have had he been the legitimate son of a notary. But, you know, he learned to write, he learned to create paints, to mix pigments and prepare panels and so forth. So he had a bit of an education. But for the rest of his life, he tried to self-educate him to the level where he thought that an artist ought to be.
Dr. Brown, in the last few years of his life, Leonardo da Vinci lived in Rome, where both Michelangelo and Raphael were active at the time. Any evidence that he ever met either of those or talked to them?
We're actually sure that they, you know, that their paths crossed. Unfortunately for Leonardo, at that time, the Pope and his court gave him very little credibility or very little type of works to work upon. We believe that's a period of time that he may have been looking into doing anatomical drawings of, for example, a woman pregnant with a child or a fetus or human anatomy such as the heart and heart disease. We're sure there's circles path, but there was probably no type of works that they ever worked on together. Michelangelo and especially Raphael were put up on a pedestal, and that was part of the reason why Leonardo left in 1516, 3 years before his death, and moved to France to live with the French king.
Well, no knock on Michelangelo or Raphael, obviously great artists, but, you know, if you look at the overall body of work, my goodness, there's hardly a match to be found for Leonardo da Vinci, right? Wow.
I would definitely agree with that. And, you know, at that point, Leonardo was an older gentleman, and the artists were in favor, and especially the ones that were involved in sculpture. And I believe that probably did bother Leonardo. But at the same point, Leonardo had somewhat of a reputation for sometimes not finishing his works. And, you know, the Pope and some of the others didn't want to put, you know, the monies towards an artist who might not finish their work or who was near the end of their artistic period of time. What is amazing, though, is we believe that some of Leonardo's most important works were done in those last 6 years of his life, such as Madonna and the Yarnwinder, the Louvre Mona Lisa, the Saint Anne, the Virgin and Child, and, of course, his last painting, John the Baptist. Some of these are his most beautiful paintings and really show the skill level of the artist.
One final question, Jean-Pierre. You have lots of illustrations in your book, The Da Vinci Legacy, right?
We have over 120 beautiful color illustrations, and the publisher, Apollo, did a beautiful job. So it's really a color illustrated book throughout. And in fact, if your listeners would like to get a little preview, they should go to the website, Leonardo Books, that's plural, leonardobooks.com, and they'll get a beautiful preview of the book and its illustrations, and a little preview as well of the documentary with Morgan Freeman that's currently airing on public television.
Co-author.
And there's also links for them to consider purchasing the Da Vinci Legacy on Amazon, which makes it very simple.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Brown. Co-authors of the Da Vinci Legacy, Jean-Pierre Isbouts and Dr. Christopher Brown. Thanks, gentlemen. Great to talk with you today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Sure. So long now.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
In 2019, Tri-River celebrates 25 years as your Butler neighbor, providing exceptional musculoskeletal care in the community.
Hi, I'm Dr. Tom Mazzanegro, known by many as Dr. Muzzy, and I'm an orthopedic hip and knee surgeon. Patients do best when they are engaged with the process, educated, and invested in their own well-being. At Tri-Rivers, the patient is at the center of everything we do.
To learn more or to schedule an appointment, visit TriRiversMSK.com or call 1-866-874-7483.
Thinking about remodeling or refinancing your home? ARMCO Credit Union's new HELOC combines the flexibility of a traditional home equity line of credit with the low fixed rate of a home equity loan. Lock in different amounts, rates, and terms up to 20 years under one convenient loan agreement and monthly payment without the hassle of reapplying as your borrowing needs change. It's never been easier to join, so call or visit us at one of our locations or online at armcocu.com to become a member. ARMCO Credit Union is an equal housing lender and is federally insured by NCUA.
That frightening sound is one we hear quite often throughout the day. Our heart quickens and immediately we wonder what happened. A medical emergency can be frightening. Every tick of the clock crucial. And that's why Butler Ambulance Service is dedicated to be there with every ounce of care possible. Butler Ambulance Service is within minutes of providing you or a loved one with treatment and transportation. Call 282-9595 to find out more. Butler Ambulance Service is a phone call away from serving you.
Coming up on the It's Your Turn program here on WISR, I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guest is Catherine Eban, investigative journalist, award-winning investigative journalist. We're talking about her new book, Bottle of Lies, the inside story of the generic drug boom. Catherine Eban, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us here today.
A pleasure to be with you.
So over the past couple of decades at least, I think most folks are aware of the boom in generic drugs. They're cheaper, and that seems like a pretty good deal. And, you know, they say they're the same as their more expensive counterparts. So what's the story? What's the problem with generic drugs, Catherine Eban?
So I'm an investigative journalist and began looking into this in 2008 when I got a tip from a radio show host who said that patients were calling into his program complaining about symptoms and side effects from generic drugs. And he'd gone to the FDA and, you know, presented these complaints and basically were told, well, it's psychosomatic, the drugs are fine, they're bioequivalent, which means therapeutically equivalent, don't worry about it. And then he contacted me and said, I think there may be something wrong with these drugs, but I don't know what it is, will you investigate? So I began looking into it, and I quickly realized that, you know, just reporting the symptoms of U.S. patients wasn't going to answer the questions. And that the answers lay thousands of miles away in the manufacturing plants where most of our generic drugs are made, which is India and China. So the majority of our drugs are made in these overseas plants that the FDA does regulate and does inspect. But what I uncovered is that there is widespread falsification of quality data in these plants, and that they are presenting data to FDA regulators to get approval to sell their drugs based on fake data that fundamentally misrepresents the quality of their drugs.
Wow. I was astonished, quite frankly, at the percentage of generics that are being consumed here in the United States. 90%, is that right?
That's right. 90% of our drug supply is generic, and the majority of those drugs are manufactured overseas. So when your listeners go to a pharmacy, for sure they're getting generic drugs that most likely have been made in remote Indian drug plants.
Who is manufacturing these drugs? I assume that they're pharmaceutical companies in India and China. Are they not reputable?
Well, some of them aren't. And one of the principal companies that I focus on in my book is a company called Rambaxi. It was India's largest drug company, had a sterling reputation, but a whistleblower named Dinesh Thakkar approached the FDA back in 2005 with just horrendous data that reflected that the company was widely inventing quality data and not doing testing of its drugs. And these drugs were reaching American consumers. So fast forward to 2013, the company was indicted and ultimately pled guilty to 7 felony counts of falsifying data. But I wanted to know, was Rambaxi just an outlier or the tip of the iceberg? And that's what I went to investigate and found out it's the tip of the iceberg, that this is how an industry that is really focused on the cheapest possible manufacturing and the maximization of profits, this is how it operates.
I've read a lot of wire stories about how some manufacturing in the U.S. has gone overseas, for example, clothing, shoes, even cars, the assembly of cars, and the prime rationale seems to be cheap labor. Is that the prime motivation for these generic drugs being made overseas?
Absolutely. Cheap labor, cheap supplies, so that when drug and less scrutiny from federal regulators. So, you know, when the FDA inspects a U.S. drug plant, it shows up unannounced and stays as long as needed. For inspections that are overseas, what I uncovered is that the FDA announces its inspections weeks and sometimes months in advance because they say it helps with logistics. And you know what happens in those plants? They have 2 months lead time that the FDA is coming. They actually send in data fabrication teams to create documents, shred documents, fabricate data. They clean up bird infestations, lizard infestations. They invent sterility data to show their plants are meeting sterility requirements. And, you know, this is where a lot of our drugs are being manufactured.
We're talking, listeners, if you've joined us a few minutes late on this segment of It's Your Turn, we're talking with Catherine Eban, award-winning investigative journalist, about her new book, Bottle of Lies, the inside story of the generic drug boom. By the way, the cover of your book has a bunch of blue pills spilling out of a bottle. Is that any specific generic drug, or is that just a pretty picture?
Well, I think those are the designers at HarperCollins who created a striking book cover, but that doesn't relate to any particular pills.
So what did you find out about some of these generic drugs that are being dispensed to U.S. patients? They don't have the right ingredients. They don't have enough.
Right.
They don't work.
You know, because of this fraud and because of what the FDA has failed to either detect or stop, I expose in my book that patients are getting generic drugs that are not actually bioequivalent to the brand name drug. So that means they don't have the same absorption in the blood as the brand name drug. U.S. patients have gotten generics with glass fragments in them, drugs with toxic impurities in them, like, I don't know if you've focused on this widespread recall recently of two blood pressure medications, Valsartan and Losartan, because they were found to contain carcinogens that are actually used in the production of liquid rocket fuel. And those were manufactured in a Chinese plant. The active ingredient was manufactured there. So, you know, these drugs, they may have unapproved ingredients, so that these companies have gone and switched ingredients in the lab and not notified the FDA and not gotten approval. And this scheme is so sort of widespread that it essentially makes us all guinea pigs, because we're getting drugs that have not been adequately tested.
I don't know whether it's the same in all states across the country, Catherine, you may, but here in Pennsylvania, if you go to the pharmacy to get a prescription filled, there's a sign right there that says Pennsylvania law allows pharmacists to substitute approved generic drugs for brand names. Is that the same all over the country, or is that just here in Pennsylvania?
You know, the laws do vary from state to state, but by and large, my understanding is that that is true in most states, that pharmacists are not only allowed, but in some places required to make generic substitutions. You know, and the FDA is telling us that that's fine because all of the drugs are interchangeable. You know, but my investigation is revealing that, in fact, they're not.
You also say in your book, Bottle of Lies, that the funding for the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, their funding is tied to the number of approvals they give out. That's kind of startling.
That's right. And in fact, you know, as I was closing this book, the lawyer for my publisher was like, could that possibly be true? How can that be true? But it is true. Under a 2012 law that was passed, and the shorthand name for it is called GDUFA, that law provides for generic companies to give user fees to the FDA based in part on how many applications they get approved. So, you know, the FDA is really tied to these companies for its own funding. You know, there's good arguments made for that, in that the funding helps to send more regulators into these plants. It can also speed up generic drug approvals. You know, but there are quality issues embedded in this. You speed up generic drug approvals, and that permits companies to send the FDA fake data, and the FDA is under pressure to approve applications. So it's really a double-edged sword.
Is there any way for consumers to know that if the generics that they're getting and taking are in fact identical to the brand name?
So this is a great question, and it's one I've been getting a lot, as you can imagine. I have some information on my website, KatherineEban.com, about how patients can essentially investigate their own drugs. There is no way to know for sure, but there are things that they can check, such as, has the manufacturer making their drug been in a lot of trouble with the FDA? How can they figure out if there are other manufacturers that make the same drug? Can they find what's called an authorized generic version of their drug? And that is a cheaper version of the drug that the brand name company actually authorizes. And so it's made essentially with the same recipe, the same manufacturing steps, and sometimes it's even manufactured in the same plant. So I lay all that information out for readers on my website, which is KatherineEban.com.
Catherine's last name, listeners, is spelled E-B-A-N, Eban. Could you talk to your pharmacist about this, or would they know, or would that not necessarily be all that reliable either?
You know, I really encourage patients to talk to their pharmacists. I think some pharmacists know a lot about this, some don't. They won't be able to tell you exactly where your medicine was manufactured, because that's considered proprietary. But they may be able to communicate if other patients have complained about certain drugs from certain manufacturers.
Who did you talk to over the course of your years of investigation into this?
So I did reporting on four continents. I interviewed over 240 people, which includes regulators, whistleblowers, pharmaceutical executives, diplomats, a lot of people. I obtained over 20,000 confidential FDA documents from sources. So, you know, the book is a detailed narrative of what is happening behind the curtain at these distant drug plants.
I'm sure your information is news to a lot of people. I have seen numerous wire stories about the dangers. Apparently, there's a lot of people these days who are buying drugs over the Internet. I don't know why, instead of talking to a trusted pharmacist.
But
I've seen numerous stories about the dangers of that, you know, you don't know where they're coming from, Canada or whatever, you don't know what's in them and so on and so forth, but that's over the Internet. I didn't hear anything about what you're talking about in your book.
Right. I mean, you know, for the Internet, that's a real buyer beware situation. All bets are off. But, you know, here we're talking about FDA-regulated products that we're all getting at our pharmacies. And, you know, there are real questions about whether these drugs are being adequately regulated.
One final question. Did you talk to the FDA, or would anyone there speak to you with regard to your book before you went to press?
Well, I requested a lot of information and interviews with FDA officials. They declined interviews. They provided written answers to a lot of questions. You know, I think that I can't exactly put words in their mouth, but I think their basic position is they have the same regulatory system and the same standards for all drug plants, whether they're in India or Indiana. And, you know, that is a system on paper that is identical. And the question is, well, what's happening in reality? And that's the question I wanted to answer.
Author Catherine Eban is a Fortune magazine contributor. She's also written for Vanity Fair, The Nation, other publications. She formerly worked as a staff writer for The New York Times and The New York Observer, and she was a Rhodes Scholar. The title of her expose book, Bottle of Lies, that's the title of the book, Bottle of Lies, The Inside Story of the Generic Drug Boom, by Catherine Eban. She's been our guest here on It's Your Turn. Catherine, nice to talk with you today.
Super talking to you. Thanks so much.
Sure. So long now.
Bye.
Hi, this is Howie Pinckney with Pinckney Capital Management in Portersville. Today, many people need help managing their investments. The investment options available today can be confusing. If you would like to talk to someone for help, why not call me for an appointment? Howie Pinckney at Pinckney Capital Management, 1284 Perry Highway, Portersville, Pennsylvania. My telephone number is 724-368-4224. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor.
At Osterling's Lawn and Garden, there's plenty for you and your pets to be excited about. They have pet fountains from 80 to 125 ounces, along with 25 and 50-pound Van Hess pet food storage containers. Fill those containers with some of their grain-free dog biscuits. And with summer celebrations in full swing, you may want to consider picking up a Comfort Zone calming vest for your dog. It can help with anxiety, thunderstorms, and those summertime fireworks. You can find it all at Osterling's Lawn and Garden in Butler.
Are you sick of chronic pain and all that goes with it? You are eligible for your medical marijuana card. How do you get your card without the hassle? Compassionate Certification Centers for your medical marijuana card or CBD visit. Visit cccregister.com. That's cccregister.com or call 888-316-9085 today. Compassionate Certification Centers can help you get your medical marijuana card and connect you with certified doctors that can answer all of your questions.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey.